Excelsior. Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Good morning. Welcome to Solder Smoke 52. This is Bill, M0HBR, here in central London. I guess the word for today is Excelsior. Those of you who were fans of AM broadcast radio in the United States during the 1970s will probably know who and what I'm talking about. Excelsior was one of the trademark words of Gene Shepherd. And Gene, or Shep, as his friends and fans called him, was a radio personality and humorist, stand-up comic, best-selling author, and most of us came to know him via his programs on WOR AM radio in New York during the 1970s. My father and I used to sit up at night and wait for Shepherd's show to come on every night, and Shep would tell stories about his childhood and his experiences in life, his observations on the human condition. It was all great stuff. And one of the things that Shep did from time to time was to talk about his experiences as a radio amateur, as a ham radio operator. Shep was not at all shy about talking about his experiences in our kind of strange antisocial hobby. And it was through those stories that I probably got interested in ham radio. So I did at one point have an opportunity to thank Shep for exercising this influence on me. One morning, I guess it was by this time, probably the mid-80s, one morning as I was getting ready for work in New York, I was listening to WMCA talk radio in New York, and it was the Long John Nebel and Candy Jones show, and it was towards the end of their show. It must have been about 5 o'clock in the morning, so I was there at the tail end, and their guest that night was none other than Gene Shepherd. So I decided to give him a call. I figured at that hour of the morning I wouldn't have that much competition, and sure enough I got through to Shepherd, and there on WMCA we had a nice little chat about ham radio, and I thanked him for putting me on the road to this technical hobby. It was really nice. I started thinking about Shepherd this week, and I did some Googling and found a few wiki sites, and then I hit the treasure trove for Gene Shepherd fans. Believe it or not, guys, somebody has taken almost all of his shows, almost all of his recordings, almost all of his speeches, and made them available on the internet. And I found the site. I've posted it on the Gadgeteer.news website. I did this with some trepidation because I feared that as soon as I did this, all of you would stop listening to Solder Smoke and immediately start listening to Gene Shepherd all the time. But I decided that I really owed it to you all to let you know about this site. So there it is. It's posted, along with instructions on how to find the radio-related programs. That's what I did. I did a search on the site for programs that seemed related to radio, and immediately found those episodes that I was looking for. I could almost remember hearing these particular stories that Shep shared during his broadcast days at WOR. And as I was sitting here, I mean, I really, as you guys will, I found myself laughing out loud at some of the things he was saying. They just were so true, and they hit so close to home. And realizing that another Solder Smoke was on the horizon, I jotted down some notes and some things that he said. So I'll go through this with you just to give those of you who are doubtful about whether you want to listen to this or not, a sense of what's available in these programs. And just because I thought they were a lot of fun. He talks about, for example, how, and this is a very sort of quintessential shepherd comment, he talks about how as a young man you come to a crossroads. He says that one path will take you to success in life. The other path leads you to ham radio flea markets. Obviously, we have chosen the second path, gentlemen, and here we are. He talked a lot about, in one of his programs, I think this was a 1965 program, about his amateur radio license. He talked about the effect on his, I guess what you'd call today, self-esteem as a teenager when he got his Class B or general class ticket. He must have been, I guess, 12 or 13 years old. And he talked about the difficult process of preparing for the exam, of learning the Morse code, of studying the theory, and then going down and facing the Inquisitioner, the radio examiner, the FCC official in that scary federal office building. He went down with two of his friends. They all took it together and then began the interminable wait for the verdict from the Federal Communications Commission. He talks about how happy he was when he finally got that license, and he used a phrase that really hit home with me. He said, at that young age, because he had that license from the Federal Communications Commission, and because it had been so difficult to get, he walked around all the time thinking of himself as W9QWN, a man of substance. I know exactly what he was talking about. I had the same feeling way back when in 1973 or 1974, I became WB2QHL, a man of substance. Shep talks about some of the things that he did in order to pass the exam. He talks, for example, about sitting in his school geography class with the ARRL license question and answer manual hidden inside the pages of his geography textbook. And as the teacher was droning on about geography, he was sitting there studying for his license exam. Shepherd's first receiver was commercial. It was called the Sky Buddy. He remarks in the show about how the great romantic names of radio equipment from those days, and how he also hints that those days are behind us, and we don't have those kind of cool names for radio equipment. And he cites one piece of gear that I have some experience with, and this is one of the comments that really made me laugh. He mentions the receiver, and you guys who are Boat Anchor fans will know exactly what I'm talking about here, the Hammerlin Super Pro, or SP600. But Shepherd has this great radio voice, and he let this name of this receiver kind of resonate, the Hammerlin Super Pro. And then he paused and he said, man, that was a radio name. That was a name for a real radio. And then he put it in very kind of Gene Shepherd terms. He said, that was a name with gonads. So, three cheers for the Hammerlin Super Pro. I had one time. And I wanted to work on that thing, but I chickened out. Because even the 1960s era QSTs, even QSTs from the time when hams were hams, frequently commented on how really difficult it was to work on those Hammerlin Super Pros. So I sent mine off to eBay, and a better ham than I is working on it. Let's see. Shepherd said that because of ham radio, he ended up growing up in his basement working on ham radio gear. He said he developed the complexion of a fish, with his glasses growing thicker by the day. He said something about radio magazines and a teenage ham's attachment to radio magazines that that really hit home with me. He talked about how, as a teenage ham, he would read every page and every line of every QST magazine that came his way. You guys know what I'm talking about here, because you've all done the same thing. This was, of course, in the days before the internet, the days before QRPL, the days before we had other sources of ham radio information. In those days, it was just the magazines. Shepard said that he can remember sitting up in his room late at night, reading the advertisements in the back pages of QST, reading about the different diameters of grommets that were available. he did this, he said, with real fascination, even though at that point he did not even know what grommets were. But he read them anyway, because he read about them anyway, because it was in QST. He went on, in one of the shows, he talked about the trials and tribulations of a home brewer, and how when you're trying to build something, when you've built something and you're trying to get it to work, you can become really, really obsessed. He says that, for example, he had saved up and finally got enough money to buy a modulation transformer for his 6L6 rig. His first transmitter, of course, was a homebrew rig. It was a what was known then as a QSL40. It was a 6L6 one tube transmitter, and he had gotten a modulation transformer for it, and now he was going to try to put it on AM using a system called Heising modulation. And he put the whole thing together, and I guess at this point he was probably around 14 years old, and he tried to get it to work, but it wasn't working properly. He would get on the air and people were reluctant to talk to them, and when they did talk to him, they kind of gave him these very disheartening reports about how bad he sounded and about how he was creating noise all across the band. And, man, he was frustrated. And the worst thing about it was, right in the middle, right in the most critical phase of this kind of debugging process, what we'd call a debugging process today, he had a date. Because dating was now part of his life, and he had agreed to take this young lady out. And with all of these problems of Heising modulation on his mind, he went through with the date. But it was obvious that his heart wasn't in it, and his mind he was a million miles away. He was, as he went through the date, as they went from the ice cream parlor to the movie theater, it was obvious that he wasn't thinking at all about the young lady. His mind was on troubleshooting. His mind was on Heising modulation, gentlemen. He was trying to figure out how to get the transmitter to work. You know what I'm talking about. We've all been there. Anyway, he said that it got to the point where he was so distracted, and I think he made the mistake of mentioning to the young lady what it was that was causing him such worry. And she stopped in the middle of the date and told him that she thought that there was something seriously wrong with him, and said, quote, "Your mother should take you to a doctor." And he tried to get her to understand, but she just couldn't and wouldn't. And he pointed out that, as he said, nothing is worse than when you've built something and you can't get it to work. And maybe my mother should have taken me to the doctor too, but I understood what Shepard was saying. He went on to point out, however, about how a few days after this less than successful date, he was able to work out his problems with the modulation circuit, and he went home, and after a late night of soldering and debugging, he got that transmitter to work, and he fired it up. He fired it up on 160, and he started getting excellent reports about his beautiful, clear AM modulation. And he said, "You guys, you know," he said, I know how it feels for those who have topped Everest. I know the feeling of success. I know that feeling. And those of us who have successfully debugged some gear know exactly what Shepard was talking about. Anyway, this is the kind of stuff that awaits you on the Gene Shepard website. Like I said, you'll find the URL on the www.gadgeteer.us site, along with some hints on how to get past the other material that he has there, because he does talk about other things, of course. But it gives us some hints on how to focus on the radio material. So I recommend it. I think you'll like it, and for many of you, it'll be a blast from the past. For the younger listeners, it'll be something new. But even though he was transmitting back in the 1970s and 80s, I think almost everything he says about ham radio will resonate, certainly among the home brewers who listen. All right, let's see, what else do I have next here? Oh, yeah. You know, amidst all this kind of inspirational stuff from Gene Shepard, I have to bring you a bit of news about something disturbing. You know, I have Google Alerts. I don't know if you guys know about Google Alerts, but Google Alerts lets you ask the Google folks to provide you with an email alert anytime something on a specific topic pops up. You know, if you're trying to track a news issue or a website or something like that, you could set up a Google Alert. And I have Google Alerts set up for solder smoke, because I just like to see if there's any mention of the show out there. I like to hear what people are saying about it. It's a good way to get feedback. Anyway, this morning I got a Google Alert message on solder smoke, and it was kind of disturbing. It didn't actually have anything to do with the podcast, but it's a subject that I think will be of concern to all of you. It seems that there is a move afoot, and again, it's weird how the Google search engine gets this to you, but it seems that there's a move afoot in the New Jersey State Legislature to get this, to ban the use of soldering irons in the home. Usually we don't get into any kind of politics or any kind of discussion. We've avoided completely the CW versus no CW debate. We have not mentioned broadband over power lines here on the show, because I think all of that kind of falls into the political category, and we've tried to keep this show strictly apolitical. But this one really kind of hit close to home, guys, because it's, in essence, they're trying to ban solder smoke. Not the podcast, but the smoke itself, if you can believe it. Apparently, commercial electronic industry is involved, and there was hints that they fear interference to Wi-Fi networks from people who are building homebrew electronics gear. It looks like they're trying to make this happen by claiming that there's a danger from lead in the solder and from the smoke. They're using the term secondhand smoke danger. You get the picture. There's also hints about fire safety and insurance concerns. All of this apparently is coming together in a bill that is apparently moving with some success through the New Jersey State Legislature. And apparently there's also a hint that it could lead to nationwide federal legislation that would, in essence, put us all out of business. Oddly, I did some checking, and the ARRL has been completely silent on this issue. But I think that we should get involved in this one. This one could really hurt. So I think I would ask all of you who are concerned about this to send me an email, and I'll collect them, and we'll get them to the appropriate authorities. The bit of legislation is known as NJHR 040107. I think it's up to us to try to put a stop to this one, to put a stop to this effort to quench the solder smoke. Can you believe it? Anyway, send me your emails and let me know what you think about this. Send them to soldersmoke@yahoo.com. Certainly an appropriate address for that, and we'll appreciate your support. Speaking of solder smoke, talk a little bit about what's been happening on my bench here. I've been slowed down a bit this week. You guys might be able to hear it. I've got a cold. I'm on the mend. I'm almost completely recovered, but I just find that I can't melt too much solder when I'm not not feeling 100%. So I've been away from the bench. I've been doing a little bit more with the virtual workbench of LT Spice. Those of you who use this program will understand what I'm talking about here, and those of you who don't use it yet, well, I'd encourage you to give it a go. As my British neighbors would say, it's really a very worthwhile program, a lot of fun. I think you'd like it. And I would suggest you give it a try. I did some research on it, where the term spice comes from. And I know many of you guys who use spice programs at work will probably know this, but I didn't know about it. I didn't know much about the history of the program. SPICE stands for Simulated Program with Integrated Circuit Emphasis. It's apparently the real purpose of this program was to help people model and predict how integrated circuits would perform, given the fact that they were very expensive to develop, and you didn't want to just do a multi-million-dollar cut and try effort. You had to come up with some way to predict how these chips would work. Of course, we're able to use the same program now for our much simpler and less sophisticated discrete circuit projects. I found that SPICE was originally developed in the 1960s at the University of California at Berkeley, and there was an earlier version of it, and the earlier version had a name. Get this. What a piece of marketing brilliance this was. The name of the earlier version was Cancer. Man, that's a tough Google ad right there, I'm telling you. Anyway, what that stood for was Computer Analysis of Non-Linear Circuits Excluding Radiation. The excluding radiation bit was apparently a political shot coming out of Berkeley in the 1960s, as you could imagine. What was going on was that a lot of the DoD contracts for modeling programs included the requirement that the program be able to predict how the circuits would react to radiation from a nuclear explosion. So the folks who developed this program were apparently not into the whole nuclear explosion thing. So that accounts for the last two letters, excluding radiation. Anyway, I've been playing around a little bit with LT Spice and using it to predict the performance of my evolving 20-meter transmitter. It's been very slowly evolving on the workbench. I substituted the ceramic oscillator that I had developed, and I substituted it with a crystal oscillator, and it goofed up the whole project because I had designed the amplifiers for the low-level output of the variable ceramic oscillator that I've been telling you about. The output there is really quite low. And I put this crystal oscillator in there, actually a variable crystal oscillator, and not only was the output significantly higher, but it was not at all cleaned. It was just a really ragged-looking, much more powerful signal. So not only was it overdriving my carefully designed amplifiers, but it was overdriving them with a really ugly, very non-sinusoidal signal. So, anyway, back to the drawing boards with that. Back to the 14.3 megahertz ceramic variable oscillator circuit. And it seems like this thing is just destined to be a phone rig. So that's what's happening there. One of the other reasons I haven't been building much this week has been that my kids have been off from school, and we've been involved in all kinds of different projects, many of them up here on the workbench. But, for example, we went out one day this week and built bows and arrows with great success, and had to set up a kind of an archery range down there in the garage area. So that's the kind of homebrewing that we've been engaged here at M0HBR. Nothing terribly exciting from the in the electronics area. Hey, but now that we're getting to the band sweep segment of the show, we do have something that's very exciting. We have a special guest edition of band sweep, and I'd certainly like to encourage others of you out there to do this. We have a special segment that's been recorded by Ray M0DHP Ray happens to be fairly close by here. He lives southwest of London, and he's very nicely recorded for us a band sweep segment, and it's something different. It's something that I think many of you will find new and interesting, but at the same time strangely familiar. Ray has recorded for us a pass over London of the amateur satellite Fuji Oscar 29, also known as JAS-2, or Japan Amateur Satellite Number 2. This bird was launched on the 17th of August, 1996, from the Tanegashima Space Center in Japan. It's a small device. It weighs only 50 kilos, or a little over 110 pounds, launched by the Japanese Amateur Radio League, and it's a transponder. It takes uplink signals from the 145.9 to 146 megahertz band, SSB or CW, and then repeats them back down on a downlink from 435.8 megahertz to 435.9 megahertz. Again, SSB and CW. It's really neat, and it reminded me a lot of my own adventures with satellites. I played with RS-10, RS-12, and some of the with Mir and some of the space shuttle operations with the International Space Station too. But it's really neat that the segment that Ray has recorded for us includes quite a bit of CW, so you guys, CW fans, will find something that you like. You'll hear some of the SSB chatter from around Europe and what a pass like this sounds like. You'll hear the Doppler shift. You'll hear how the signals shift around, and especially the SSB signals, you'll hear them kind of come in and out of tune, and that's caused by the Doppler shift. That's caused by the high velocity of the satellite as it approaches, as it goes overhead, and as it goes towards the horizon. I mean, you realize that this thing is moving at a velocity of about 17,000 miles per hour. That's right, gang, 17,000 mph. It's in low Earth orbit. It's not way high up there. It's pretty close. So it goes from horizon to horizon in about 10 or 15 minutes max. And Ray has given us about 7 minutes of this pass. It's really interesting, and I think it's really cool because just last week, I think we were talking about the International Geophysical Year, and there's an IGY element here. So let's turn it over to Ray, M0DHP, and Fuji Oscar 29.
Hello, this is Ray, M0DHP, with a band sweep on one of the amateur satellites, FO29, Fuji Oscar 29, and this pass is on the 25th of March 2007 at about 15:30 UTC, and I'm recording it from my QTH, which is southwest of London in England. FO29 is a linear satellite. You transmit up to it using SSB or CW in the 2 meter band, 145.9 to 146 megahertz, and the signal is retransmitted down at UHF, 435.8 to 435.9 megahertz. But what we're listening to now is the beacon, CW beacon from the satellite. A good way of checking that you can hear the satellite okay. And it's also in telemetry. If you look up this code in a lookup table, it'll tell you about the status of the satellite, different temperatures and voltages on the systems. Okay, so now I'm going to tune away from the beacon onto the speech pass band and immediately hit up my QSO. Let's listen. You can hear the pitch changing slightly, even though my rig is Doppler controlled by my PC. I still need to adjust it slightly to keep in sync with the QSO. As the satellite orbits and gets closer to me, as it is at the moment, there's a Doppler shift, changing the frequency that you receive on. Okay, I'll tune around a little more. So I can manually tune my rig, and then once I leave it in a particular position, the PC will try and keep it tracking the signal that's received. Now we've hit another QSO, and I recognise this voice. Vinicio, IK3VZS is a regular on the satellites. Okay, I'll carry on tuning down through the downlink band and see what else we can hear. Beacon. It's not the satellite beacon. Let me just wait to see if I can pick up the call sign. At this speed, even I should be able to read it. Yes, I saw something about this on the AMSAT bulletin board, OZ7IGY. This is actually a bit of a historical beacon. It was built back in the International Geophysical Year, 1957, I think. And I saw something that said it's been reactivated for this weekend as part of the anniversary. And it happens to transmit in the uplink frequency band for FO29. So this is coming from Denmark, up to the satellite and receiving it here. So, quite unusual to hear this. It's a one-off, I think. Okay, we'll tune around some more. On this pass, the satellite sort of rose above my horizon just about south, and it's heading off to set about northwest from my point of view. Still good reception at the moment. OR4P, I think. Even leaving aside the beacon, as you'll hear, quite a lot of Morse activity, CW activity. Yeah, that's Vladimir from Belgium.
Right.
French station calling, and no reply. If I wasn't recording this, I would definitely have given him a call. So the satellite's getting lower now. I'm going to lose it behind some buildings soon, I think. But I hope you found that interesting. A band sweep slightly out of this world.
Well, fine business, Ray. Really excellent. Very interesting. Thanks a lot. Gentlemen, as you know, the gong signifies that we've arrived at Cider Smoke Mailbag. Sort of keeping up with our 1930s Gene Shepherd Cider Smoke theme this week, here's a story from Gene Shepherd's part of the country. Shep was born on the south side of Chicago. We have a story here from another Gene. He spells it differently. Gene, AK9N. He's commenting on something we talked about a few weeks ago about the AM radio BFO story. We had Greg W. from up in Finland talk to us about how he had used an AM broadcast band receiver as a BFO for a teenage shortwave listening in when he was living out there in Western Australia. Well, Gene writes in, and it says here, "Hi Bill, I meant to comment last week about the AM radio BFO, but time got away. Way back in my high school days, class of 1966 here, while reading one of the then current electronic hobbyist magazines, I tumbled as to how received signals, local oscillators, and IF amplifiers all fit together. My brother was a Chicago White Sox fan. Their games were broadcast on WMAQ, 670 kHz, out of Chicago. To test my understanding of the theory, I tuned my own radio down to 1580 kHz. Cool. The White Sox play-by-play went away, to replaced by the much stronger signal from my radio's local oscillator. Brother was not pleased. Neither was Mom when I fessed up. Keep up the solder smoke. I look forward to downloading each episode and listening to the adventures. 73 Gene." Well, thanks very much for that, Gene, and I think that's really interesting. It's fun to hear about the teenage or youthful radio adventures of the listeners, and I guess that does square away the business about how to use that thing as a VFO. We've got another one here. I've got to move the gong. It keeps resonating. Watch this. Listen. Hello. You hear the resonant there, yeah. I'm going to put the gong back in the gong box. Got another nice letter here. This one is actually from Jeff, KE9V. And he relays to us a letter that appeared in the 1930 edition of QST. Again, this is, I guess, part of the nostalgia theme for this show. It went to the editor of QST, and it was about a guy who had fallen away from ham radio and home brewing, but it was brought back to the fold. It says, "Dear QST editor," now realize, guys, that this is written in the very kind of florid style of the 1930s. "You might tell me, if you can, whether the last vestige of our famous and virulent fever ever leave the veins of an erstwhile victim. For lo, I had the persistent bug completely gone, but his devious ways surpass the understanding of man. Yesterday I came across QST in the library, and its familiar but strangely different pages. Therein I came across Reddington's picture of a station of days gone by. My eyes felt slightly misty and my throat a little tight. A few years ago, I was one of the regulars, and although always more of an experimenter than an operator, the love of the hobby is about the same, as you know, in both. Putting myself through college and working at the same time has taken all my energy for the past 4 years, but it's all over now, and now I am a full-fledged lawyer. The other night, however, I must needs tear the broadcast receiver to pieces and put it together again. There's something infectious about the feel of a soldering iron and the smell of burning resin. Oh well, send me a new handbook. I've got to see where things stand. 7-3 from John C.L. Cohen, X8BYR, in Birmingham, Michigan. Well, fine business, John, and fine business, Jeff, for relaying that to us. I'm sure we can all identify with what John was saying about being pulled back into the hobby by that familiar smell of burning solder smoke. Well, guys, I think on that inspirational note, it's time to wrap this one up and bring it to a close. My throat seems to be about reaching its limit of transmissions right now, so it's a good time to wrap it up. 7-3's all around. Have a good week. Keep those emails coming in. And thanks for listening to Solder Smoke. 7-3 from London. This is M0HBR.